Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
And good afternoon from Southeast Florida, everyone. This is your host, Daria Ann. I am an author, blogger, and founder of the RightStream Radio Network, and I thank you for joining me today. I have a wonderful returning guest, Roy M. Griffiths, better known as Griff on Facebook and Twitter and everywhere that he's online. And I'm so psyched. He was on last week with our mutual friend Jamie Wilson talking about Liberty Island Magazine and the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance on Facebook. And I'm hoping, you know, today we're going to first give Griff a chance to talk about his work and his career more in depth, and then we're going to segue into a nice discussion about the culture and all the ways in which creative patriots can kind of participate in turning our culture around and really telling better stories that are really going to appeal to people on an emotional level, yet tell them the truth. So I'm really excited about today's show, and I invite you all, if you want to call in with your questions and comments, the number is 347-945-7246. That's 347-945-7246. I noticed we have a few guests in the chat room. Welcome. If you have a question you'd like to ask and you don't want to call in, feel free to type it in chat, and I will be sure to pose it to Griff. But I want to go ahead and just kind of read a little bit from his bio on Liberty Island, and that's for anyone listening, and I'm going to put the link into the chat room. It's libertyislandmag.com, and it's an awesome, awesome site. And if you are a pro-liberty person and you love your country and you also love fiction, let me tell you something. This is the site for you because there are tremendously talented people on there, including Griff. And you can find them and all of their stories at libertyislandmag.com. So please check that out. But this is from Griff's short bio on that site. Griff has been a waiter, a janitor, a book salesman, and a U.S. Coast Guard rescue swimmer, finding this last occupation to be most similar to being a writer. Says Griff, quote, "At the end of the day, it all comes down to what you and you alone do." And that is certainly the truth. And so without any further ado, I want to welcome my friend and fabulous writer, author, and patriot, Griff, to the program. Hey, Griff.
Hey, Daria, thank you. It's a real treat and just an honor to be here.
Well, it's always fun having you on, Griffin. I love talking about the culture and writing and all of these topics with you. But I want to, well, let me just give you a chance to kind of introduce yourself again. And, you know, let's talk about some of the novels you've written and what you're working on now and some of your short stories.
Well, let's see, I've been a book salesman, a janitor, or stop me if you've heard this before. I've done a lot of things. I decided when I was 10 that I wanted to be a writer. Let's see. Real briefly, my family is going through a tough time, and I wandered into a used bookstore in Tucson, Arizona, some years ago at 10 years old, and there on the shelf somebody had given up their entire collection of Edgar Rice Burroughs' John Carter of Mars, and you know I had some change, so I picked up the first one and got home, started reading it. When I looked up like 6 hours later, I said, "I want to be a writer," because the book for me, which you know is probably unreadable now as an adult, was so magical. It actually took me away from where I was and exposed me to you know a new world. And it was like the only magic I'd ever encountered that was real, if that makes any sense. And I said, this is the kind of magic I want to do. And ever since then, I've never looked back. I've done all kinds of things to pay the bills. You know, I've run a jackhammer at the bottom of a swimming pool in a California summer. But whatever I've done, I've written. And I wrote short stories when I was younger. I moved into plays. High school, and after when I was in the Coast Guard, I annoyed some of my Coast Guard buddies. I had a typewriter that was in my locker when I lived aboard an 82-foot patrol boat, and I'd be doing the midnight watch to make sure the boat wasn't sinking or on fire. And when I was done with my rounds, I'd sit there with this old manual Smith Corona, I think it was, on my lap, typing, working on my plays and stuff. So no matter what I've done, I've always written.
That's excellent. Griff, I'm just sitting here laughing. I'm thinking to myself, does anybody under 30 even know what a Smith Corona is? How far we've come. I remember.
Google it.
I definitely remember. But I can relate to that. You know, it's true. I've been in and out of the corporate world, and no matter what else I was doing, and at one point, you know, not too long ago, I was delivering deli food, but I was always writing on the side, so I can definitely relate to what you're talking about. And it is so true. I mean, writing is just like a mental vacation. It costs you just about nothing, next to nothing. And you can really just get lost in a story and just be completely transported to another world. So I totally agree with that. And it sounds like for you it came at really a good time in your life.
Yeah, I mean, Edgar Rice Burroughs saved my life. There's the beginning of a memoir for you. But that's my goal as a writer pretty much ever since then, is to take people, immerse them in another world, another reality. And make it believable, which is sometimes really tough when you're writing fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember who said it, but some writer said that, you know, telling the truth is easy, but fiction is hard because fiction has to make sense.
You know, that is so true. And having written both, I can relate to that also. It is, it's sort of paradoxical, but it's definitely true. So, Griff, is By the Hands of Men, I know when you were on my show last year, we talked about this, and I know this is a series, By the Hands of Men, Book 1, The Old World. Now, was this your first novel?
Actually, no. It was my second. My first novel is called The Big Bang, Volume 1 of the Lonesome George Chronicles. And speaking of being in the corporate world, I was running a PC help desk for a large financial corporation in Southern California, and I just sort of had the idea one day. It was sparked by a lot of things. Particularly, I was annoyed a lot with the way the press was treating the Iraq War and George W. Bush, and I'd wanted to write something nonfiction about the real truth of the Iraq War. The major press, refused to show people jumping out of the Twin Towers on 9/11 because they didn't want to inflame passions against Muslims, yet they were falling over themselves to make sure that every time some bodies came back from the Middle East, their cameras were there to record it and to keep the body count going. And that's one of those things where there's the truth, but it was also something so screamingly unfair is the only word I can come up with. Unfair about it, that on one hand, when they need to protect people or ideas, they're going to shield the delicate public from the reality. But then when they wanted to pound an evil Republican, by God, they were going to make sure you saw everybody. And that sort of thing, plus the fact, you know, Cindy Sheehan, you know, she was covered endlessly and repeatedly at press conferences every time she was outside George Bush's house. And, but you know, I mean, poor woman, her heart was broken, understandable, but she was just being used as a tool. And, of course, as soon as a saintly Democrat was elected president, she completely disappeared from the public airwaves because she was no longer useful. Anyway, that was the sort of thing that was really pissing me off. And since I didn't have access to the kind of information I needed to write a nonfiction story about all the things that were actually going right in Iraq, all the good things the Americans were actually doing that, again, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post didn't talk about because it didn't fit the myth they were making. I started thinking about, well, what would change these guys' minds? And I realized they had a kind of experience and a view of the world that made them quite comfortable with saying, yes, evil Republicans, and everything Republicans do is evil, and we're going to do everything we can to show it. But as soon as a Democrat appears on the scene, Well, we're going to forget all that, you know. And so then the next question becomes, well, what kind of experience would these propagandists have to have to change their mind, to make them go, golly, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe what I'm doing is wrong, and maybe the picture of the world I have is incorrect. And that became the beginning of Lonesome George. The Lonesome George Chronicles imagine America after Al-Qaeda has launched a series of attacks on us, coordinated series of attacks on major installations. It's shaken the political system, the infrastructure, and to me that's the kind of thing that might make people go, golly, perhaps there were some things I wasn't looking at. And I just started from there. Most of my writing, just like that short story Shadows you were referring to, begins with almost a throwaway thought, or I wonder. And with Lonesome George, the title itself came from my thought, you know, how lonesome George Bush must be getting beat up like this. And something about that sparked me, and that almost became the first line of the story, imagining someone, a character, wondering, you know, where's Lonesome George now? And I just went from there.
Well, excellent. Well, I mean, first of all, Griff, I remember that whole time period, and I share your frustration. And what a great way to go about it is to create a fictional character based on all of those events. You know, the thing that, and I don't want to get too far off track here, but the thing that used to make me want to pull my hair out, though, was how he got such bad advice, President Bush. Like, he just didn't fight back, and I think, fight back, you know, stand up, say something. And so I think something like, you know, Lonesome George is invaluable. So now you have book one of that is out. Like, tell us a little bit about that and where people can find it.
You know, we were talking about the corporate world. As I said, I was working at this PC help desk, so I was getting up at 4 in the morning to start writing this. And I'd previously been a writer, a screenwriter, and I'd sold something to Fox TV. And in a completely typical Hollywood story, by the time I finished the last draft, they fired that particular vice president whose project it was, and all their stuff went in the trash, and I could never get anything going again. You know, it's a cliched story, but it was true for me. So then I actually had to, you know, I said, well, golly, I have a 2-year-old son. I guess I have to get real now and get a job. So that's where I started in corporate America. So at this point, I was just writing the story simply for myself, just because it was sort of an interesting world, and then it just took over. And, you know, it's a conservative alternative history. It features real and fictional characters, which I had quite a bit of fun with. Characters based on people in this current timeline, but it becomes a different timeline, so I think I'm okay there. But I'd written it mostly for me. And then when I heard about Liberty Island and their strong stand on more conservative points of view, I thought, well, heck, I'll submit the first chapter to them. And they wrote me back and said, hey, can we see the rest of that? And then shortly, well, several months after that, they said, we want to publish this. So Lonesome George is actually going to be the first novel Liberty Island publishes.
Fantastic. And when will that be coming out?
We're not sure exactly. It's looking like, I'm going to say September or the fall. Okay. I would love for it to come out before the elections.
I was just thinking that at the same spot.
If we can annoy a few people or make some people think, that would be great. But, right now they're still working out some details, but it's looking like September or the fall.
So now, Griffey, is this going to be a series, Lonesome George? You know, this would be like the first in a series type of
thing? It's the first book, and I'm working on the sequel now. I'm about 300 pages into Lonesome George 2, continuing the events of the story, and just sort of going wider with what happens. It's going to be a series of some kind. I'm not sure how many books. I mean, we've all read series that after about the seventh book, you go, wow, this guy's tired. You know, he's run out of steam. And I don't want to be that guy. So how many, I don't know.
And now, Griff, tell us about, you have another series, By the Hands of Men. So tell us a little bit about those books.
Okay. Entirely, almost an entirely different kind of book. And that's been my problem with having a career as a writer, either in Hollywood or as a short story writer, a playwright, because I don't seem to have a thing other than wanting to move people emotionally. You know, I've won some awards with my playwriting, but every play was different. One was a comedy, and one was a serious historical drama, and one was a glass menagerie-ish sort of autobiographical play. My screenplays were all over the place, and so I just write whatever interests me at the time. I've got this great children's play about a frog, a prince who thinks he's a frog. And that's for children. So, you know, I just have to write whatever strikes me. So I'm not going to be, I don't know, Mac Bolan writing, you know, 110 stories of The Punisher or whatever it was. So that's just a long-winded way of explaining why By the Hands of Men is actually historical fiction that starts in the First World War in the trenches of France, actually. And is a story of a wounded English lieutenant who meets an English volunteer nurse. Well, let me rephrase that. She works for the English volunteer nursing division, but she's actually a Russian immigre. Her parents had seen the writing on the wall in Russia and brought her to England before the revolution started. So it's the story of how they meet and how they sort of fall in love, and it's entirely different sort of story than Lonesome George, and I've even tried to write it sort of with the conventions of the time, so there's no boinking, shall we say. There's very, very, you know, I think there are like two or three outbursts of profanity. The rest of it's referred to as, you know, colorful language that surprised somebody, that sort of thing. Because I was trying to really write it as if you were there, as if you were in that time period with their thoughts and that sort of thing. And book one pretty much follows the two characters as they as fate intervenes and takes them apart. And it ends, well, I don't want to tell you how it ends, but it ends with them unsure of where the future will bring them, and we've fallen from the trenches of France to revolutionary Russia, where they learn that the hands of men can create a hell on earth, or through the redemptive power of love, a heaven in which they could live. But that's where the title comes from, is that idea that, you know, it's in our hands. We can create heaven or hell in many, many ways.
Yeah, very profound.
Again, just a story that struck me, and so I've finished the first draft of books 2 and 3 in the series, and those will be out later this year, actually, I think.
Okay, now, are they also published by Liberty Island?
No, I self-published By the Hands of Men on Amazon. It's available there under By the Hands of Men.
Okay, great.
Roy M. Griffiths.
So everybody go to Amazon.com and check out By the Hands of Men by Roy M. Griffiths. Yes, and Griff, I mean, I'm really, this is next up in my, I've got a very big to-be-read pile, and yours is there at the top, and I'm really looking forward to that. One thing I want to ask you, because I read Shadows on the Liberty Island site, and, you know, one of the things that really struck me about that story, well, one of many things, is the first-person point of view, I think, is so powerful in that story. Now, do you tend to use that? I mean, does it depend on what you're writing? I mean, do you use that all the time? Or tell us a little bit about that, like how you decide.
Oh, I wish I knew. When I write, it's almost like I'm taking dictation. I can hear it, and I can sometimes see it. And at a certain point, you know, I'm hearing it all the time. And I think first person in general works better in a short story. At least that's it. My other novels, all my novels have been third person. So it just worked for that story at the time because I could see it so clearly, and that was just again another throwaway. I was actually reading a magazine, I think it was like a photography magazine, and it was talking about the history of camouflage and things like that. And there was a throwaway, probably two lines, talking about.
Griffey, still there?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh my gosh, I do not have sound, ladies and gentlemen. I am not.
Oops. Hi, Daria, are you there?
Hey, Griff, I am so sorry. Blog Talk Radio decided to kick me out. So I apologize.
The it's quite all right. I need to drink some coffee anyway.
So I was saying, this
two-line throwaway about something about a German camp and what had happened to it. And that's one of those things I read, and my question is often, I try to imagine, what did it feel like to someone to be there? And that, I could see so clearly, that sense of what it must have been like. I just started writing in the voice of that person, and that's why that one was first person.
Yeah, it's very effective in that story. And I wanted to ask you too, Griff, because you know, it sounds like you've written a lot of different types of writing: short stories, plays, novels. Do you have to shift into a different mindset for each one? I mean, is one more challenging than the other? Like, what are some of the, I guess, I don't know how to phrase the question, but when you sit down to write a short story versus a novel, like, what are some of the differences?
Let's see. I think almost how I write it and what format almost depends on the story and what seems like it would be the most effective way to tell it. That's the first consideration. Short stories are nice because you can usually sit down and write it in one sitting, and you almost see like the whole thing. For me, and there are people who don't do this, but for me, when I write novels, and since I'm kind of new at writing novels, I'm figuring this out as I go. I know where I'm beginning, and then I have a picture of the end, but I'm not sure necessarily how to get there. But it kind of reveals itself as I write.
Yeah.
By the Hands of Men was based on almost two separate ideas, ideas that were separated probably by 15 years. The first spark was when I was speaking to an older English woman in community theater who was then telling me a story she had heard from, say, her grandfather, who was in World War I. And he said one of the most awful things about fighting in the trenches was you'd be down there and you'd listen to the wounded horses scream.
Aww.
And no one could go out and help them because, you know, I mean, World War I was probably like the last draft animal war we've actually had. And just like you said, my thought was, Christ, what would that be like to be there? You know, to be that person listening to that. And that was just that image, that image, that idea stuck with me for a long, long time. And then 15 years later, I had another idea, which I'm not going to tell you, another same kind of question, like, you know, what if or what would it be like to be that person? And then one day, a couple years ago, suddenly the two linked up. So I knew where I was going to begin with that image in the trenches of France, and I knew where I was going to end, and I just didn't know it would take me 1,000 or 1,500 pages to get there.
I love the whole creative process and how things just evolve. And one of the things that's most cool about it, I think, is that it's such an individual process. And, you know, we're all rugged individualists who love our liberty and our country. So I think that's really cool. I love hearing these stories.
And since you asked, the other difference is when you're writing a play or a screenplay, the actual format of those is so oddly structured. Those are actually ones where you have to sit down and write out the story. But even then, that almost becomes the last screenplay I wrote. I ended up doing a 20-page single space treatment, which in essence was a short story of the play, the screenplay. But once you have that, then you spring off that and you can deal with all the formatting and the structuring of the play, of the screenplay then. But that's almost a requirement of the art form itself. So if you're lucky, there's still some art left.
So, Griff, let me ask you about the independent publishing process or the self-publishing process. First of all, what are your thoughts on it overall? You see this as a net positive for writers and readers?
Yes, with some limitations that I haven't quite figured out how to overcome. Certainly, I had submitted Lonesome George more of reflex than anything else, to a couple of publishers, and I think it just, you know, it was like dropping a rock in a well. You know, I waited a long time to hear just a faint clink and nothing else. You know, who's publishing conservative alternative history? Maybe Bayon. But even then, it was an offbeat kind of thing that may not have appealed to them. So, I'd actually done a small self-published run of Lonesome George, just, you know, like give away copies to my folks and things like that. And then, you know, again, same thing by the Hands of Men. I've won some writing awards, but that doesn't really cut it with, your average publisher. And it's certainly, again, not the – it's that lack of a clear genre. It's not a romance. It has, you know, elements of romance in it because love, I think, is an important part of life and gives us a lot of energy to do a lot of things we might not do otherwise.
Yeah.
And so it just sort of fell in between. So self-publishing it worked for me, just in the sense of having it available to a wider audience. But the question is, how do I make the wider audience aware of it? You know, the marketing and the how do I get it in front of people who will tell other people?
Yeah, and that's definitely the key. But before we get into that, I want to ask you, we're talking about just the process of self-publishing. Who do you use? And, you know, did you, you know, when you first decided to do that, did you spend any time, like, kind of investigating different self-publishers that are out there? Because I know for a lot of new authors especially, that's also a challenge.
I did some, and this was, I did Lonesome George right before Amazon's Create Space really took off. And so I went with another kind of, it'd probably be called a vanity press, but I'd had a bonus that year, and I figured, what better use than, you know, on me? And so that was an okay experience. But certainly any royalties out of that were laughable. So for me, Amazon worked well, having their having their ebook platform and the print-on-demand platform. I found that they seem like the best combination of production and presence, because everybody knows Amazon.
Right.
So that was why I ultimately went with Amazon.
Okay, and do you find, because I know this, and this is, you know, even in the CLFA and other writers groups I belong to, it's always the challenge. I mean, Amazon, it's kind of like it's sort of like a mixed blessing, I guess, or at least for some people, because it's everywhere, everybody knows it, and yet they sell things at such a low price that you really have to make up for it in volume.
True. Golly. That's yeah, you're right. It's certainly a double-edged sword. It's there if people want it, but you got to make people know it's there, and that's the conundrum, really.
Yeah. So, before we move into marketing, another thing I want to ask on behalf of, you know, aspiring authors and people who, want to go into self-publishing, they want to self-publish, they have stories, or even if they've already written, you know, they've published things previously and they're, you know, ready to release something else. In terms of the process with independent publishers, let me just ask a general question. Do you feel like we're kind of, I mean, it's great, and I'm one of the beneficiaries, too, of being able to publish something without dealing with gatekeepers and their biases and their agendas and all of that good stuff. And then, of course,
right. The
challenge is finding and connecting with your readers. But also, just in terms of quality, though, I mean, do you feel like we're under more of a microscope as, quote-unquote, independent authors, and we're sort of held to a higher standard, and therefore, you know, authors should, you know, hire editors before they put their work out there?
Yes, as the upstart, you know, the people tilting at the windmills of our betters. Yes, we are under a much greater microscope, and it would not. I would say if you don't have access to a really competent editor who will work for milk and cookies and back rubs. I think it would be really worth your time at a certain point to hire an editor. The odd thing, though, as you mentioned, is I don't know if you've noticed this. Lately, I have seen a lot of traditionally published fiction, which seems to have a number of glaring editorial errors. I wouldn't in the past have expected of that kind of book, which makes me almost wonder if the traditional publishers are doing less of that heavy lifting as time goes on. Maybe in response to economic pressures, like they've had to cut back on staff. But repeated word use on the same page is sort of thing that we as authors cringe at, going, "Oh no, I've got to find a different verb there." But but in answer to your question, yes, absolutely. You need to have another set of objective eyes. And if you've got to, you know, put out some cash for it, well, you know, sell your high school ring or something.
Well, you know, that's one of the things. We have an upcoming panel on May 20th on Writestream Tuesday that I'm real excited about. I've got some really fabulous authors that are going to be joining me and experts in this area. But, you know, one of the things, you know, when I interviewed Jack July a couple of weeks ago, author of Amy Lynn, I mean, he mentioned how he was able to crowdsource editing for him. And I think if you're really on a tight budget, and here's where the importance of networking comes in, too,
yes.
Because, you know, the paradox with writing, as you said in your bio, yes, at the end of the day, it comes down to what you and you alone do in terms of producing it. But there's also the value, the flip side of that for the marketing side is the value of networking and connecting with like-minded authors who are willing to maybe, you know, help you out, you know, maybe read. And, you know, maybe it's not the same thing as hiring somebody, but, you know, there are people out there who have good eyes, they're good editors, and maybe it's not milk and cookies, but they'll work for for the benefit of helping another like-minded author kind of get their work out there. I mean, I found that to be the case.
Yes, I have too. I just finished reading Kia's Underlake, and I'm going to be putting a review up on that because I found it really, a very, very good young adult novel, even for a grizzled person like myself. I enjoyed it a lot, and I found it compelling, and so I want to do what I can to support that. And then, you know, there's people like Jamie Wilson. Jamie was one of the first people at Liberty Island who read the entire Lonesome George piece, and it was a lot of her enthusiasm for it that I think helped convince the editor and publisher that they could take a chance on it. So, yeah, I think you're right. We do need that. We do need to support each other in what Jamie calls the movement, you know, the conservative fiction movement. It's not a genre, but it's a way of looking at the world, you know, telling a story.
And by the way, Kia is in the chat room, so want to say thank you, Kia, for joining us today.
And by the way, she's a good writer, and I'm encouraging her to get to work on her next novel. And she also did the cover for By the Hands of Men, and it's an outstanding cover, I think.
Oh, it's beautiful. You know, it's funny. Yeah. I was going to ask you that.
She's a very, very talented graphics artist, and you know, she's one of those people I'm starting to hate because she's more talented than me, and you know, but I'm learning to keep that envy to myself.
Yeah, I can relate. I think about that sometimes too. I'm like, damn, she's a great writer and she can design covers. You know, what went wrong with me? You know,
yeah, she can probably sing and dance too. Yeah, so yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. I don't know. I mean, Kia, do you dance also? Let me know. Let us know in the chat room or call in 347-945-7246. But yeah, I just put another shout out to her. Two shout outs. I read Under Lake, but I'm really looking forward to it because if it's even like half as good as Night Machines, I know I'm going to absolutely love it because I loved Night Machines. I thought that was awesome. And you know, she did an outstanding job with the book I've just ghostwritten called Steps to Salvation. And you know, the whole process of collaboration with her was just seamless. You know, we went back and forth on colors and little things that my client wanted, but it was just, she's one of the easiest people to work with that I've ever worked with on anything, really. And she delivered on time, and my client was very happy, which means I'm very happy by extension. So, yeah, and it's great. You know, it's just, just as a shout-out to the CLFA group, I mean, the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance, so many multi-talented people, and again, just getting back to new technology and social media and self-publishing, I mean, I'm thrilled that it sort of unleashed the creativity of people who wouldn't have a voice otherwise, you know, because let's face it, I mean, you know, and you said this before, Griff, I mean, are there even any publishers out there that even want to publish a book that, like, celebrates American exceptionalism or, you know, traditional morality or, you know, within the you know, within an entertaining story. No, there aren't many. No. I can't even think of any offhand.
No. You're right. Especially this idea of unleashing creativity. There was this Mark Twain story called Captain Henderson's Visit to Heaven. And one of the, he's describing all these things in heaven. And again, this is Mark Twain, probably about 1890 or so. And talking about, he's having dinner, and let's see, Chaucer and William Shakespeare got in a fight over the right to serve the dinner to, you know, this guy named Joe Smith, who had lived in some little town in Missouri, because he was a better writer than they were, but nobody ever knew it. And with the advent of these technologies, you're right, a lot more of people's creativity has the opportunity to be out there. One of the members of CFLA, Christopher Bunn, has written really interesting fantasy trilogy, which I've just started. I haven't gotten very far through it. But he's also a musician, and he's written some really cool stuff that I've had a chance to listen to. Again, without the technology, without this movement and this gathering of like minds, not similar minds, let's say, not like minds, wouldn't have known about Christopher Bunn or Kia or you, even.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, funny you mentioned Chris Bunn. He was my guest a couple of weeks ago, and that was a great, very interesting, talented person that I see. But okay. You know, in Griffin, getting back to, you know, we were talking about budgeting too, and I think one of the reasons why so many people in CLFA and other like-minded groups, you know, pro-American, pro-liberty groups, are so willing to help is because they recognize that. And they understand the importance of, you know, one person's success really is everyone else's success because it uplifts the movement. So the more successful we are as individuals, the better off it is for everyone. The better off it is for the group, the better off it is hopefully for the country as we start to turn this culture around. And I find that people really get that.
Yeah. Well, I think they get that. They also recognize there's a real hunger for those kinds of stories, because those kinds of stories actually, I think, reflect a lot of Americans' lives. Whereas reading the latest New Yorker fiction of, the academic in his high rise and the existential angst he's going through because he feels like life is meaningless, that doesn't resonate with people who are out there working in, you know, the mechanics shops and then going to church and contributing their time to the local food bank and that sort of thing. So I think that's definitely part of it. Not only is it lifting up, but it's recognizing people want this.
Yeah,
it just hasn't been available.
You're absolutely right, because it doesn't reflect reality. It's trying to drive an agenda, you know, on that side. And I think, you know, with what I've seen in the CLFA movement is that you have talented people who write good stories, who happen to be pro-American and pro-Constitution, but the stories are entertaining. They're not
the good stories first, yes.
Right.
Right. I tend to agree. You know, my belief is it's story first, and whatever sort of who you are will come through, and what you believe will come through. But if you start out the other way, then you're just Michael Moore. You've got an anvil to beat. GM bad, union good, whatever it is, and then you stop being concerned about both actual truth and emotional truth. Both of which I think are important, but as a writer, I think emotional truth is more important, ultimately,
yeah.
At least in fiction. You know,
what did Jamie say? Like, news stories inform your mind, but art and fiction inform your soul. Something like that. Jamie, I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing, but I know you said something like that.
She does.
And it's so true.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. We're talking about stories, and that's one of the things I've really come to believe over time is that what's really important is, what stories are we being told, and then what stories, in turn, do we tell ourselves? Because I think that's how we make sense of the world is the stories we tell. I think that's how we learn things is we end up telling ourselves stories.
Yeah.
And this is the story of the hydrogen atom who met its friend, two friends, the oxygen atoms, and then they became water. Whatever it is, but we have to make sense of the world, and I think we often do it in story, whether we realize it or not.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I know vexes me, and I suspect vexes you, is the stories that the modern myth that has been told for the last 40 or 50 years, starting with the 60s, and what P.J. Rourke called the biggest temper tantrum of all time by that spoiled generation, they told an entirely different myth of the world and of America. And that myth has become, in a way, the unconscious internal reality of a lot of people, because they haven't necessarily been exposed to anything else.
Destructive.
Yes, I mean, you see the myth. You know, in the past, it might have been a myth that was told by the king and the parliament and the church, but now that myth is told through the popular media. And once you become aware of it, it's very hard to escape. The my favorite example, which I used last week, is Stephen King. His novels, his stories, his really interesting, fun stories a lot of times when they're not completely icky. But it's like, my golly, as soon as you see someone who's known as a Christian, you know they're going to be a terrible hypocrite. And the Republican, my golly, that Republican is going to be the bad guy who did something for money and let evil into the world. You know, and you read enough of that, and you're like, oh, man, geez, hasn't this guy ever heard of that Senator Jackson from, I think, Louisiana, Senator Clinton, who had $80,000 in bribery cash in his freezer?
Yeah.
We don't hear about that. Or Mitch Snyder, very famous homeless advocate, very, very well-known in the 80s and 90s. He was a wife beater. Don't hear about him, you know, because that's untidy, and that doesn't fit the myth, because the flip side of the myth of the evil Republican, the hypocritical Christian, is the saintly Democrat, you know.
Yeah, oh, of course. Yes, they're all saintly. I mean, the list goes on and on. I'm thinking Lyndon Johnson, Ted Kennedy, no war on women on his part. No, he just, you know,
right.
Wanted to drown.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this great Esquire story about Ted Kennedy and how awful he was to poor, lower-class serving people. He might as well have been the count abusing the serving girl.
Yeah.
But that story doesn't get told. You know, he's the lion of the Senate. No, he was a scumbag. And, you know, Bill Clinton, he gets awards for being, you know, a friend of the feminist. He wanted to be the friend with benefits of the feminist. And, you know, and again, he just gets a pass because he says the right thing. And, you know, they think he's going to support the correct positions. And that's just the sort of thing that infuriates me. I mean, I actually fear in some ways for America, and I'm sorry, I'm staying up on my soapbox now, because I think in some ways Americans are very hungry for someone with principles. And I actually have this sort of weird, niggling paranoia that if we ever got somebody who actually held true to their stated principles, Americans might actually want to make them a leader, regardless of whether those are good principles or bad principles. They just are so tired of people like Barack Obama, who, you know, is such an empty suit and, frankly, the affirmative action president. You know, he was elected and pushed to that position on no merit, other than the fact he wasn't George Bush, and he was not a person of pallor. You know, but Barack Obama said he'd be all these things, and he's, in fact, there's an old term from the pulp, something about a 10-pot dictator, is what he's amounting to. You know, and again, the press and the people telling them the myths give him a pass. And it's up to us, so I'm stepping off the soapbox now. It's up to us in the conservative fiction movement to begin presenting an alternative mythos, an alternative story of our country, our culture, American capitalism, and conservative values. And I think one of the things that's actually going to help that, once we can start to overcome a little bit of the entrenched protectiveness of the New York Times and the Washington Post, is that it's going to resonate more with people where they live right now than a lot of the myths that the left is telling.
Yeah, I agree. And let me just add something. You know, one of the myths that I most despised, Griffith, I mean, this is something that came to mind, but it's one that's been, I think, has been very pervasive. If you look at film, not just books, but film and music and movies over the years, is this whole myth that somehow suburbia is like a horrible place to live. I never understood that. I mean, I was blessed enough to grow up in a beautiful suburb because my parents, you know, my dad, who came from immigrants and worked three jobs through medical school to become a doctor, was able to move us to the suburbs, which was a lovely place to live. Like, I don't know if it's part of the Agenda 21 thing where they're trying to drive us all in these little tiny cramped urban spaces and, you know, because, God forbid, we cannot be trusted with animals or take care of the earth. I mean, I think that's probably part of it.
Yeah.
But I just don't understand what all of these kids growing up in the suburbs, what the hell are you rebelling against? That you live in a nice house? You live in a free country? Is that what's bothering you? Is it that we're so free that we've taken our freedom for granted to the point where you actually have to manufacture things to be upset about? You know, it's just really frustrating.
Well, it's interesting you say that. You notice that in there'll be sort of trends like that in the early, you know, I want to say the 30s and 40s, that became the D.H. Lawrence thing about the distant father who had no no sense of culture, and therefore his son, who went to university to learn about these beautiful things and learn about Renaissance art, they had nothing in common. His father was brutish and cold, and would fall asleep, at listening to the radio or whatever it was. You can read those from the point of view of the rebelling child, but you recognize after a little life experience, dude, your father was tired. He was working in the damn mines all day so that you wouldn't have to. And you didn't appreciate that. All you saw was, oh, whoa, I am so unfortunate. And, again, that goes back to me, that P.J. Rourke quote about the temper tantrum of the 60s. They had all of this stuff, and they didn't understand what it had. They had no sense of the cost, of what it cost in terms of their parents and where their parents had come from. They had no appreciation. There was sort of a narcissism focusing on only me. And I think that has certainly affected America since the 60s. There's been a very, I call it the teening of America. And to me, Bill Clinton was, the first teenage president, because it was very much about him and his appetites. And that's such an immature teenage point of view.
It is, I think it was Diana West back in, 2006, came out with an excellent nonfiction book called The Death of the Grown-Up.
And I know the title, but I don't know who wrote it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was her. Remember Michelle Malkin back when she had Hot Air and she would do the videos on there? She actually did an interview with her, and she was talking about, one of the points she made was like somebody like Bono, this was back in 2006, and I know he said some good things, I think, recently about capitalism, but, Bono at his concert telling people to rail against the establishment, and she's like, he has no self-awareness to understand that he's become the establishment. I mean, he's worked hard at his craft. He's become very successful. He is the establishment, and it's just so, she was just so on point, and you're right, we're dealing with the culture of perpetual adolescence, where people just don't want to grow up and take responsibility for anything.
Right. Well, I mean, that's certainly the liberal response, is it's always somebody else's fault.
Yeah.
And that after a while that gets old. You go, wait a minute, you guys did this. This was your choice, and this is what you wanted to have happen, and you're not taking any ownership.
Well, it benefits people in power to have a nation of whiny crybabies as opposed to a nation of self-reliant, the hardworking people who don't want or need government intrusion into their lives.
Yeah. And again, that's where we, as part of the conservative fiction movement, tell a different story. We have to change the story that people hear, and it's tough. We have to get past the New York Times, which was so happy to reveal classified government programs when it would hurt a Bush administration, but then they don't publish things that are perhaps hurtful to the same Democrat administration. And we could do example after example of that. But when we have to get past that, if it's a grassroots rebellion, if it's the Samizdat, if you recall those from pre-Gorbachev Russia, those were the mimeographed magazines that were passed around by hand by the underground in Russia, that were pushing for freedom, that were pushing for revolution and changes to the system. That may be what we have to do, and we're certainly starting with Liberty Island, but the more we can spread the word, we can say to people, look, here's stories that, A, don't insult you, and B, are just good stories, and C, they don't insult you. They don't say that you're a bad person for going to church. They may even acknowledge that conservatives give more after taxes to charity than liberals do. Liberals love to outsource their compassion, which means we pay for it and they feel good about it. But You know, so it's up to us. It's up to things like Liberty Island, like Right Talk Radio, to spread the word, to let people know there are these stories out here that resonate with your life and your experience. And, you know, you can take away from it whatever message you want, but these are things where all men aren't rapists, all men aren't abusers, all housewives aren't stupid, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But we just need to let people know it's out there, and that's going to be our real battle, which we get to fight alongside, you know, just the creative battles of trying to write a compelling story that people will want to read and will enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Griff, are you up for taking a call? I don't have a way of screening, but we do have a caller on the line.
Sure, so of course. Yes, ma'am.
It'll be an adventure. Okay, caller from the 512 area code. You are on Right Stream Tuesday with Roy M. Griffith.
Hey, it's Chris Baker. How you doing?
Hey, Chris.
What's going on?
Well, you get to hear what I really sound like now, but I love how you've been talking about, you know, what's been going on with the teening of the America. I never heard that phrase, but it's something that's been going on a long time here. We've really extended childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was a time when you were 13 or 14 years old, you were expected to go out and, you know, start working. And you know, we've completely overhauled that. And I think there's a sense where we've now just put people in, you know, the creation of adolescence is one of the, it's a relatively new thing. You know, nowadays we don't even expect people to act like adults when they're 25.
True. Well, you know, I think it's been one of a real detriment to the nation, too, because we were talking about the people rebelling against suburbia and all that sort of thing. I was thinking, when a kid was, as you say, 13 or 14, and they lived on a farm or something, they had chores. You know, they had to get up and feed the chickens and milk the cows. And it may have been onerous, and it was probably unpleasant to get up at 5 in the morning in a Minnesota winter. But at the same time, it would be inescapable to know that your existence had actual meaning, had an effect on the world in a positive way. The chickens didn't get fed. The cows didn't get milked. That had consequences. So your life, your very existence counted in some way. It may not have been a large way, but I think that's missing in a lot of people's lives, and certainly a lot of young people's lives. You know, you don't show up with your iPhone. Well, what does that really do to anybody's life? Not much.
Yeah. You know, you still kind of get some of those values in kids who grew up in small towns too, or in the country. It's
true.
You know, that's one thing that the kids in the suburbs don't get at all. And I think that's one reason why there's a big difference. And of course, I grew up in a small town. And the other thing too is, growing up in a small town, I was better off than most of the kids in that small town. But I at least was still aware of the fact that there were people who, you know, couldn't even afford spiral notebooks for school.
Right.
You know, the kids in the suburbs don't even know that anybody like that exists until they're, you know, in college or whatever. And they're just wondering, what happened here? It's definitely, and we've gotten to this place, too, where they're just so more and more protected anymore. I mean, you know, where they all have to be kept safe from everything, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that disconnect from my life has meaning is pretty profound. That's one reason I encourage any young person I meet to go to the military, because you can see that you have a real effect on the world, and it's going to change your picture of yourself. But if you're just drifting through life, you know, on student loans and then an internship and whatever, at a certain point you're going to say, wow, you know, I'm not really, there doesn't seem to be a lot of value to my existence. And that's going to translate to the story you tell about the world and life and how awful everything is.
Well, and I think that's one reason why a lot of kids nowadays seem to have a very positive attitude toward just doing any kind of volunteer work, whether it's going down and helping at the animal shelter or going to a nursing home or something like that. They seem to like it because it gives them some kind of meaning. And it's funny, these kids who go out and want to do volunteer work, they're really happy about it, they're positive about it. But then you ask them, do you want to do anything with the government? They say, no way.
Right.
Because they figured it out. I just hope that, you know, there's still time left to save the ship definitely one thing that I think kids get some meaning in life is just going out and doing volunteer work. But it's even
that's
harder.
Very encouraging, Chris, actually.
Yeah, it's very encouraging.
I just want to allude to something Griff said a little bit earlier, and I think this is kind of related to the perpetual adolescence. But, you know, there's all this demand put on fathers, well, parents in general. They have to be at every single baseball game, and if you're not there, you're a bad father. You know, and I think, you know, I remember growing up, I mean, you know, my dad, he was a surgeon. I mean, I think he missed my Holy Communion because there was an emergency. It was a life or death situation, and he had to go take care of it. I mean, you just understood back then that sometimes things came up. And obviously, you know, I grew up in a traditional home. My mom was really, like, the one that did all the heavy lifting in terms of parenting. But I just don't understand this idea. And, Griff, it gets back to what you were saying. You know, dude, your father was working, so you could have a better life. But
yep.
There's a pervasive attitude in our culture, like, oh my gosh, that father's got to be at every game, or that mother, if we'll say it's a working mother, has to be at every game. And I just think, how ridiculous is that? I mean, I understand special events. I mean, don't take this the wrong way, but I just feel like it's gone way too far in the opposite extreme.
Yeah.
Well, another thing that's changed, too, you know, is the number of kids that people are having. I mean, you talk to kids that grow up in families of four or five, and then you talk to ones who grow up in families of one or two. There is a big difference.
Well, I was the youngest of five, so.
That's one thing I said, you know, still being single. You want the sure sign of a good woman. Find a woman who loves her brother. You know, if she loves her brother, she's a good one. If she doesn't love her brother, forget it.
Yeah.
Well, I've got three awesome brothers and a sister, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and you know, that's, oh gosh, we could go on and on, but I mean, you know, and that's another thing that was kind of like a, you know, when I was old enough to be out there dating and everything, was like a shock to the system that, because I was used to having a good father and good brothers who were raised to be gentlemen, like my dad. I'm not saying anybody was, they were not perfect, they're human, but you know, the values were there, and part of what my novel, like 2008, was, you know, part of it was about my actual experience, like out there dating and trying to find people, men who came from a similar background, and
right.
So I can totally relate to that, Chris, what you're saying.
Well, and the sad thing is, I think a lot of women out there don't even value good men anymore. They'd rather, you know, they'd rather be with the so-called bad boy or the guy who's even abusive than the guy who opens doors for them.
It's
I don't think that applies to all of them, but it's certainly a substantial amount. You see a guy who treats a woman like crap. He's always got a woman. There's no doubt about that.
Can I offer my degree in psychology on that one, which I don't have?
Yeah.
I suspect that has to do. Well, I've said this to other people, and I don't know if I've said it here, but I think there's a vast spiritual emptiness in America in general and the world. If you listen to any love song, that's like a cry to God. I was nothing without you. My life is empty without you. That sort of thing. Any love song, it might as well be a hymn. But my theory about the bad women, the bad boys and the nice women, it almost goes back to that same thing about having a life that has meaning. I have this suspicion, and Daria, being a woman, can tell me if I'm wrong, and I probably am, that the appeal of bad boy isn't about the bad boy, it's about the woman herself, in that she doesn't know how special she is, so she's looking for proof. And if her love can make the bad boy a decent human being, well, then she must be a special girl indeed.
Yeah.
And it all goes back to that emptiness, that need to know that you count and you matter and you have an effect on the world. If you don't know any other way to do it, well, let's see if we can cure a bad boy.
Well, that's,
I've seen that play out with female
exactly
friends.
Right.
And let me just say this too, wait, Chris, and I'll let you jump in here. But I do think, unfortunately, even some of my female friends who are registered Republicans, let's say, and they lean conservative, too many of them have bought into the feminist tripe that being quote-unquote liberated is equal to being treated like a piece of meat. So therefore, instead of chastising like the small percentage of men back in the, you know, who were behaving immorally and just sleeping around with whoever, you know, instead of rejecting that and looking for and holding your standards higher and looking for the men who aren't doing that, no, let's just imitate that bad behavior. And, you know, women are not wired that way. I mean, the majority of us are not. I mean, there are those who delude themselves into thinking that because they think, oh, you've come a long way, baby. Well, I'm sorry, to me, being treated like a piece of meat is not liberating. It's the exact opposite.
Right.
Go ahead, Chris. I'm sorry. I had to jump on my soapbox for a second.
But, you know, it's not unusual nowadays, though, to meet girls or women who have grown up and have little or no relationship with their dads, and that does not help matters at all.
No.
And, you know, in some cases, the dads were worthless and ran away, and in some cases, the dads were basically thrown out. You know, it's a little of both, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
and again, the current part of the current myth is if that men are basically bad.
Yeah.
You know, we're all, you know, we're all potential rapists. We're all potential child molesters.
Especially
and
if they're white men, Griff, if I may interject that.
This, yes, yeah. The pasty-faced child molester. Right.
Well, you know,
go ahead,
you know, that's why I say, you know, the political left hates sex more than conservatives do. I mean, you know, the only time the left is in favor of heterosexual sex is when it's a perverted Hollywood movie director like Roman Polanski or Woody Allen. Any other time, they hate it.
Well, you know, I want to say something about that, though. Well, and I agree to a point, but the thing is, you know what's very bizarre to me, and I love Robert Stacey McCain, theothermccain.com. His blog is like a daily read for me, usually several times a day, but he wrote about this recently, about how in our culture, if you're somebody like a Tim Tebow or any kind of, you know, public figure or celebrity that says, I'm going to wait until marriage, like you're absolutely mocked. Or if you're even a football player who's married to the same woman and you have five kids together, it's like, oh, my God, five kids. It's like they're obsessed with sex, but then the fruits of sex, you know, i.e. children, they're, you know, they're totally, like, perplexed about if you have, like, more than one. Or two, you know what I'm saying? And yet at the same time, they'll glorify that same athlete who has, and I absolutely hate this expression, but who has several baby mamas. I hate the term baby mama, baby daddy. You have no idea how much I just find that so disgusting and degrading. But, you know, but the guy who's faithful to his wife and has all five kids with the same wife is ridiculed. I mean, it's just everything is completely turned upside down.
Yeah, it just about is. I don't know how that happened. I don't know why it's happened that way. Yeah, but there was the one who was the one quarterback who had eight kids with his wife. They were saying, yeah, it's unusual to have eight kids by the same woman, but it's not unusual to be an athlete and have eight kids by eight different women.
Right.
It's about the truth.
Oh, and you know, the taxpayers are funding the birth control. Go ahead, Griff.
I was going to say, Independent has a great way of looking at it, which is that basically the left is about making the government the surrogate father, you know, the surrogate family. You know, that's the government will provide for, liberated women, birth control, child care, meals, et cetera, which then makes a man superfluous, a husband-type person superfluous in that particular dynamic.
Right. Exactly.
But we digress.
And, you know, but getting back to the culture, Grip, and the way they promote that idea is by making men, like you said before, they're either, when you look at pop culture like TV shows or movies, the men are either just purely evil or they're absolute idiots who can't even, like, change a baby's diaper or they don't even know how to, like, turn on the oven or something. You know, they're just, you know, I mean, so many people love that series, that old series, Everybody Loves Raymond. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
I would watch it once in a while back in the day, but it would just great me that he was presented like such an idiot, like he couldn't even do the simplest of things properly, and that used to just bug the heck out of me.
Well, it's interesting because that's part of the devaluation of men's competency. You know, I mean, Chris can probably speak to this, but I think, you know, for a long time, one of the definitions of a man was the ability to do things. I mean, you know, Robert A. Heinlein had that whole list of, you know, you ought to be able to plan an invasion, cook a tasty meal, birth a baby, heal, comfort the dying, build a house. This whole list of things, and he said specialization is for ants, but, you know, to, again, you know, it's like let's change the vision of what a person, particularly men, are, because let's face it, I think men are more of a threat to the liberal order than women.
Yes. Absolutely. And, you know, and you know, we could go on and on. I mean, that, hence the whole pajama boy thing, you know, back in December, just before Christmas. I mean, that's the left poster child for what a man should be like, sitting in his pajamas at age, he looked to be about 26, 27, I don't know, I'm guessing, holding a cup of hot cocoa and looking all, I don't even know, I can't even describe the stupid look he had on his face, but that's their ideal man, the metrosexual.
Who wanted to punch pajama boy? I'll raise my hand.
I did. Oh, my gosh.
You know, one exception to that thing about, you know, men, I don't know if it, you know, it's you know, it came out about a month ago, and it was a TV show for 3 years. Watch Veronica Mars, because that show was one of the few that actually portrayed a healthy father-daughter relationship.
Hmm,
and,
okay.
You know, her dad was a detective. He was a detective kind of like you know, somewhat like, you know, like Jim Rockford or something like that. And just it was the rare father-daughter relationship that was actually healthy. It was reason enough why I watched it, because it portrayed a man competently, and it portrayed, you know, and she was, you know, kind of a rare, they still got along and cared about each other very much.
Okay.
Good show, just for that reason.
I will take that to heart. I'll check that out.
Yeah, it sounds like a modern-day kind of Nancy Drew. That's the first thing that popped into my head when you said that, Chris, because, oh, my gosh, I grew up on Nancy Drew Mystery Series. I used to love those books. And she had a great
relationship. Yeah, it was often compared to Nancy Drew. Because when the show was on, you know, it was, you know, as I said, you know, Jim Rockford, but she's a teenage girl. You know, secondly, you know, you talk about family values. I think The Hunger Games are a very, very much a pro-family story. If you've read those, I mean, it's all about, you know, family and doing things for your family and loving your.
I'm sorry. What's the title, Chris? I didn't hear.
The Hunger Games.
Hunger Games. Okay.
Yeah, The Hunger Games are a very pro-family story. I mean, you know, she does all this to protect her family and the people that she loves. You know, not very many people, but I definitely think it's a pro-family story. So, yeah, it's certainly worth reading all three. I read all three in 9 days, so.
All right.
Wow. Good to know. Well, guys, you know, we talked about, and I vented about this last week, Griff, when you and Jamie were on, we did our Liberty Island panel, but what do you think it's going to take before we get you know, people with money on our side, you know, conservatives with, you know, not just people like us who are doing this for the cause and we love to write and we're, you know, promoting each other, but people that have actual money that could put money behind building, say, a movie studio or a publishing company. You know, what do you think it's going to take to sort of attract that kind of attention and support so that the message can get out there more quickly?
Chris, any ideas?
That's a tough call, but I think if they're convinced it'll sell, they'll probably do it. You know, it seems to me sometimes the problem isn't necessarily the people who have money. You know, it's like what John Stossel said. You know, he said the problem isn't the people who own the networks; it's the journalists themselves. You know.
I don't know if I buy that. I think that the agenda is sort of like a top-down kind of thing, and people who go into journalism do so because they want to change the world, and they already have that sort of left-leaning ideology. I love Stossel, but I think I disagree with him on that. What do you think, Griff?
Go ahead, Chris.
It's hard to say, you know. I mean, when you look at what some of the really rich people are doing out there, I mean, the only one who's worth paying any attention to is Peter Thiel. You know, he gives money to the Methuselah Foundation. He gives money to space exploration. The Methuselah Foundation is about finding ways to, you know, extend your life and extend your life in a positive way. It's a, you know, Mark Zuckerberg gave millions of dollars to a public school system. I mean, oh, geez, you know.
My question is, I guess, Griff, I was thinking of, you know, when are they going to get it that culture drives politics, and this cultural rot is going to be, you can play around with numbers all day long, and if this cultural rot continues, we're done as a country and a society. So I guess my question is, you know, why are they wasting their money on the GOP instead of, if you have the funds to build your own movie studio, and therefore you're in control, you can produce any movie you want, you can promote any author you want, and you're a conservative and you love this country, why aren't they doing that? Maybe I should have phrased the question differently.
Well, I think somewhat similar to what Chris said. I think once people become convinced of the efficacy of it, you know, like look at the evil Koch brothers.
Yeah.
You know, they build a lot of industries, and they make people's lives better. You know, they're giving people good jobs and you know, that sort of thing. And that might feel like, to a certain extent, you know, that's how they're affecting the culture. But just recently, I think it was, I was reading the Wall Street Journal column by Peter Koch, talking about how he's recently become aware that he needs to you know, branch out into other areas. And I'm thinking, once we can start to show some movement, you know, we get a couple of conservative fiction bestsellers going, we get they'll start to see there's some value in that too, and that is also another way to change the culture and to make people's lives better, to get them, you know, more aware of the values of liberty and the principles of you know, the Constitution and that sort of thing. But I think it's going to be kind of an uphill battle to a certain point. They have to, I think these guys are very results oriented, and they're going to have to see some results first before they go, wait a minute, there is some value in this, and it will work.
And,
so it's kind of like a groundswell. Go ahead, Chris.
Yep.
I think that might be why they're not investing in Hollywood studios or publishing, is because I think there is a payoff, but the payoff doesn't come fast enough. I mean, it's going to that's going to take a while to build, and in 20 years it might start to pay off, but it doesn't pay off immediately, like, you know, giving money to a political campaign can. So I think that's a big part of it. You know, we're all kind of impatient, and, you know,
Well, Chris, no, and I agree with that, but then again, you look at the success of movies that come out that are quote-unquote conservative that people are flocking to see, and it kind of makes me scratch my head and go, why isn't somebody building a movie studio so they can make more of these? Because obviously, like Griff said earlier, there's a hunger for those kinds of projects out there. So I don't know. To me, it's kind of like there's a disconnection, I think. But.
Yeah,
right.
Well,
but on the other hand, I think for the most part we're talking about people on the right who've made money. They've made it making things, building things. And, you know, whereas a lot of people on the left who've made money have done it in, you know, those creative emotional fields. I mean, that's almost like the breakdown between the right and the left. The left is all about our feelings, and the right is all about, this is where I live. You know, this is what I do.
And I don't know, people in creative who do artists or novelists or actors, and I love actors. I know so many of them, and they have treated me so well. But so many of them are just they're way out there on the left, you know, and it's just, I don't know why they don't get the connection either, that, you know, it's that a free mind and a free market are corollaries. And, you know, free markets are the best friend that the artist ever had.
Well, the good artist.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of artists who are subsidized by the government. I mean, you know, you think of the graffiti gods from New York City. I'm thinking your average person in Nebraska, the people I went to high school with, you know, they'd say $1,000 for something a guy spray painted on the side of a wall. I'm not seeing that. Whereas
yeah.
they might drop $20 on a DVD, Blu-ray of a good movie, because
yeah.
that they get, that they can feel.
Yeah.
So there may be that too.
Sometimes I think maybe the anti-capitalist mentality just comes from the fact too that all the creative professions are overcrowded field. There are many more suppliers than buyers, and therefore they don't feel like the market really does serve them.
Right.
Because
it does.
Actors are, most actors are not, getting $10 million a picture there. I mean, I know somebody who's still waiting tables and had a significant role in a movie with Matthew McConaughey, and she's still waiting tables.
Right.
Those are the people I know, and they're great people. I love them all. I really do. But it has gotten better because the market does make things better for the artist. Professional actors didn't even exist until, maybe Shakespeare's time was the first time there might have been professional actors. And certainly when there were professional actors, that's what John Wilkes Booth was. He was a professional actor at the time. But,
right.
It's still a relatively new profession.
Yeah, and there's also, though, when you're talking about a film, I think of all the people that are involved in production, they're probably the conservative, the ones who are, the boom operators and the people doing, the hard work involved in, actually producing a film. I don't know, just a guess on my part, but, they don't get any of the glory, but they're working pretty hard, and without them, you couldn't make a movie.
Right.
Yeah, there's still that's one difference between writing novels and putting out movies. You still gotta have so many people involved. You can put out a novel for $500. You can realistically you've got to spend $50,000 to put out a movie, and that's even a low number. But.
Right.
Yeah. Well, guys. It's been a great show. I know we ran on longer than we usually do, but Chris, I want to thank you for calling in. And Griff, before we sign off, I want to give you an opportunity to let everybody know where they can find you.
Sure. You can find me at libertyislandmedia.com. I have a couple of short stories in the most recent iteration, and also they did an interview with me. I have a website, roymgriffis.com. That's GRIFFIS. Just recently learned that was a Welsh name, so that's kind of exciting. And you can find By the Hands of Men, Book 1, The Old World, on Amazon. It's available in ebook and in paperback. And if anybody happens to read it, please drop me a line and tell me what they thought. You can reach me at my website or through Liberty Island.
Fantastic. Well, Griff, I want to thank you for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure. And Chris, thank you so much for calling in because I really enjoyed our conversation here in the second hour. And I hope you guys, Chris is a recent guest as well, and hope you'll come back on the future too.
Yeah, it was great to talk to you, Chris. I hadn't had a chance.
Well, thank you. It was a good talk, yeah.
All right, guys, and you can find all of us on Facebook in the Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance, so please check that out. You don't have to be an author. If you're a patriot and you love reading books and you're looking for some good stuff to read, please join our group because we definitely, we need feedback from readers also, not just each other. So please join us there, CLFA, Conservative Libertarian Fiction Alliance, also hashtag CLFA on Twitter. You can follow RightStream at RightStream, W-R-I-T-E, stream, and also hashtag RightStream on Twitter. And, of course, you can follow me at Daria Ann, that's D-A-R-I-A-A-N-N-E. RightStream website is rightstreamradio.com. Check out our lineup of excellent shows. And my blog is dariadigiovanni.com. And next week, and Chris and Griff, I hope you'll be able to tune in. I have a new member of the CLFA on as my guest. His name is Joe Perrone Jr. He's a prolific fiction and nonfiction writer, and got a great sense of humor. So, and next week happens to be tax day, so I'm sure we're going to have a lot of fun with that. So please tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern next week for my interview with author Joe Perrone Jr. And until then, everybody, have a great week and keep rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Take care.
Bye-bye.